The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Maurice Williams, and it is my privilege to welcome you to another wonderful evening at the Intellectual Treasure Chest of Philadelphia, the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'd like to ask each of you to turn off your cell phones and any other electronic instruments that might interfere with the enjoyment of what is going to be an informative and, I think, very funny talk given by Bob Bancroft, who is returning to the Free Library for his third visit. In addition to your program notes, just a couple of observations or reports about his academic career. He is a graduate of Syracuse University, and in the late 60s was quite concerned about the possibility he might get drafted to go to Vietnam. And so one of the stories in the book is about how his poor academic record at Syracuse prevented him from getting into graduate school. So his father, ever resourceful, as he will tell you, had found an advertisement that said, guaranteed to get you into graduate school in 2 weeks in small print for $300. His father paid the $300, and 2 weeks later, he was in graduate school. If he doesn't tell you, you ask him about his experiences in his master's program. The second thing about this book, and I urge you to buy this book, this is the cartoons alone are worth more than the price, and what you learn about how to create a cartoon and how to be an editor and work with cartoonists to help shape their message is most informative. And the third thing that I would say about this book, that's why you want to read it, he will give you the way in which you solve and win the cartoon contest, the last page of a New Yorker. So that's also in the book. But I want to just remind you, before we bring on Bob, about the fact that cartoons are timeless. And so I want to just share with you from the book a cartoon that he wrote in the late 1980s. And it is timeless today because it shows three guys, businessmen, standing around, and the caption is, "As far as I'm concerned, they can do what they want with the minimum wage, so long as they keep their hands off the maximum wage." Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bob Mankoff.
Mark, thank you. Thank you so much, Morris. I will reveal all about my sojourn at Atlanta University as the only white student there in 1967. I'll tell you a little preliminary story. I went back when I edited the complete cartoons of the New Yorker and at the Margaret Mitchell House. I gave a talk, and they said, "Have you ever been in Atlanta before?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I have. I was the only white kid here at Atlanta, now Clark University." And they said, "Oh, we'll mention that in the talk." So I led, and they said, "Bob Mankoff is here, the only white student at Atlanta University." In 1967, I interrupted. I said, "Excuse me, Caucasian American." Anyway, it really is a pleasure to be here at the Philadelphia Free Library. But this wasn't free, right? Okay, well, so you win some, you lose some. All right, that's why it's free, because you're paying for the other stuff, and that makes sense. I'm going to talk about my book, and I will happily afterwards, sign the book and maybe do a little drawing for you. And if over time, because that drawing makes the book more valuable, I'd like it back. So, thanks. Let me talk a little bit about it. Well, of course, the title of the book is because this very well-known cartoon, pretty well-known anyway, of it's a guy, executive saying, "No, Thursday's out, how about never is never good for you." That's my most reprinted cartoon. It's the one I did in 1993. It's the one that gets reprinted and licensed and has put my daughter through college. So I like it. when Nancy Pelosi was on the, often quoted sort of anonymously, when she was on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, she said, when the Republicans came in, they said to the president, how about never? Does never work for you? It's also in the Yale Book of Quotations, Robert Bancroft, U.S. cartoonist, 1944. I'm not dead yet, so. Thursday's out, but never is never good for you. You know, along with that other very well-known humorous Mao Zedong. And it's also on thongs. And I don't get any money for this. On the other hand, I have free thongs. The card, it's been getting, you know, good reviews. It's actually number 15 on the New York Times bestseller list, and I think I could move up if I included a chapter on dieting. And I've looked at the O'Reilly books and how I had absolutely nothing to do with the killing of Jesus, Lincoln, or Kennedy. Good reviews, and even in the New York Post, wow, they said, yes, he is funny. I like that. That's really it. Now, how funny is it? The book is funny. Is it this funny? That's my first wife. That part of the relationship was great. But you know what? New Yorker cartoons are funny, but they're not funny in that way. Actually, that's from something I once got on YouTube. I don't know what she's laughing at. One of the things is I want to say is it actually is a book. And I write in the book, and a part of it is just my growing up, my background. And in it, I talk a lot about my mother, Molly. And I don't know if you saw the 60 Minutes episode with Molly, flamboyant Molly in the 40s, smothering, mothering Molly. Big influence on me. So here's a little thing I wrote. My mother was hovering on me. She was like a drone mother. Doting is probably too mild a word to describe my mother's obsessive attention to my existence. So long in doubt, there had been miscarriages, and which she felt could be snatched away from her at any time. I'm told that when I was sleeping, she would put a mirror up to my mouth to see if it would fog over, showing that I was indeed breathing and alive. I still do that myself every once in a while, just to make sure. I think Molly's ministrations instilled in me a potential for hypochondria, a potential that has been fully realized and has made way into a number of my cartoons with the name used in coincidence. Here's one of them. Well, Bob, it looks like a paper cut, but just to be sure, let's do lots of tests. My mother lived to be 93. She was what I called in robust ill health her whole life. Whenever I asked her, Mom, how are you feeling? She'd say, not 100%. So I'd say, what's the highest you ever reached? I just want a baseline. I want to know where we're going from. I'm thinking like mid-70s. Now, there's interesting, you know, with the book is a table of contents, something I worked through, a lot of topics I was interested in. One of them, the first chapter is called I'm Not Arguing, I'm Jewish. And that's because I've been married 3 times, Catholic, Jewish, WASP. Okay. Now it's WASP. My last and best wife, Corey Scott Whittier. So when we were dating, courting, I thought I was just talking. She said, why are you arguing with me? I said, I'm not arguing, I'm Jewish. Okay, but I'm not this Jewish. And remember, if you need me anything, I'm available 24/6. You know, one of the things I talk about in the book, you know, besides my upbringing and how I became a cartoonist, which I'll get into here, is just the history of cartoons itself and how cartoons, well, for instance, just the word cartoon. Originally, the word cartoon was just meant an underdrawing and like a Renaissance painting. Punch in the 1840s, I talk about this. Parliament burned down and they needed new paintings for the new Parliament. And Parliament was amid this poverty-stricken neighborhood, and Punch made fun of these new paintings, which were originally not paintings, but underdrawings, cartoons, by parodying them. And he called it cartoon number one, cartoon what they sure should be in Parliament. Eventually, this became, a cartoon became a humorous drawing. By 1899, this cartoon from Punch, this is what a cartoon was. The point of view, exasperated old gentleman, to lady in front of him, excuse me, madam, but my seat has cost me 10 shillings, and I want to see your hat. The lady, my hat has cost me 10 guineas, sir, and I want you to be seen. And that's a short one. One of the things the New Yorker did was that it tremendously, it didn't invent the magazine cartoon. The magazine cartoons existed after the Civil War, but a lot of them were these he-she jokes, long drawn out. Even the classic New Yorker cartoon from 1928, which many older people remember, where it's a mother and she's talking to her little Lord Fauntleroy child, and she's saying, "Eat your broccoli, dear," and the child says, "I say it's spinach, and the hell with it." That was sort of a breakthrough, just because of the vernacular used. Okay, but it's still these two lines. You know, by 1932, you know, James Thurber has pared it down to touche. So both the silliness of the line, the silliness of the drawing, for good or ill, Thurber changed cartoons in that Thurber had what I call good-bad drawing. Everything is wrong, but it's sort of right. And Thurber, who was a great writer, of course, and a great cartoonist, he would draw his cartoons in pencil and he would throw them away, and E.B. White, the great writer for The New Yorker, would pen them in and show them to Howard Ross, and Howard Ross thought that they were putting up something over him, and he never bought any of them. But eventually, they had a book out, and then Howard Ross did have him draw cartoons, and so Thurber wanted to get better at drawing. So one day, E.B. White saw him drawing, and he asked what he was doing. He said, "Well, I'm practicing. I want to get better." He said, "Don't get any better. If you got any better, you'd be mediocre." So what I do is I look at lots and lots of cartoons. And I do cartoons. I've done 950 cartoons. But mainly I'm evaluating the 500 cartoons that come in from our regular cartoonists and the 1,000 that come from elsewhere. And, of course, we have our regular cartoonists, and then we have everybody who has an idea for a cartoon who, if they happen to find me in a certain place, will, of course, tell me. Like when I went to see my cardiologist, I had an arrhythmia. And I figured, well, go to a cardiologist, right? I mean, plumbers are too expensive. Anyway, so you're sitting there on the thing, and you got your underpants on, you're all hooked up, and they want to put you at your ease. And so he asked me what I do for a living. I said, "Well, I'm the cartoon editor of the New Yorker magazine," all the while looking at my my chart. And so immediately, switches off all the machines and said, "You know, I have an idea for a cartoon." I said, "Great, I got an idea for a bypass, but if we could just, let's focus here. So the cartoons come in, and just the nature of the magazine is that the 500 cartoons that come in from the regular cartoonists, many of them are very, very good cartoons. There's only room in the magazine for on the average 17 cartoons. So we could fit more cartoons in the magazine if we remove the articles. But that would be a huge loss. One I could live with, but huge. So that's the nature of it. It's an evaluative, discriminative task. And on Tuesdays, every Tuesday, anybody, as long as they make an appointment, can come and see me and show me cartoons. And people who come, of course, cartoonists do, but Norman Mailer came to show me cartoons. And he later published them in a book called Modest Efforts, which was a very apt title. but they were in good cartoons. And David Mamet, when I became cartoon editor, sent me a very nice letter saying, congratulations on becoming cartoon editor. This was in 1997. I've taken the liberty of sending you a bunch of cartoons. I sent him back a very nice letter saying, thank you very much. I've taken the liberty of sending you a play. So the cartoonists come in, and these happen to be guys, but if you saw the 60 Minutes, and we'll show a little clip of that, there are many women doing cartoons now, and like anybody can see me. And one of the really interesting things, and I talk about this in the book, the whole intergenerational thing, the New Yorker has cartoonists in their 20s and cartoonists who are 80. So it's really an unusual institution just having that wide a span of people who are doing it. And, of course, humor changes, so we're always looking for young cartoonists. Now, the nature of the business, as I pointed out, is most people get rejected. Now, one of the things is that if you're in this type of creative field, this is the thing you have to put up with. You have to be able to take rejection. Truth is, most people can't take rejection. They can't take this much rejection. And I sometimes think that one of my great advantages growing up was my parents were just so satisfied that I was fogging up the mirror. They didn't expect anything. There was no pressure. I was let to do sort of, you know, what I wanted. Whereas, so they never, to use a Yiddish term, kveld over me, saying, you know, like if you come from a Jewish background, would you look at that? Would you look at that horse that Robbie drew? It's so beautiful. It's fantastic. No, they didn't do that. And I do think that sometimes it's a disadvantage when you're praised a lot because you actually have a talent. And your parents say how talented you are. And then you come to New York City, which is a funnel for talent. And now you're up against this tremendous competition. So a bunch of them disappear. But the people who can take the rejection, like Matt Diffie and Drew Dernovich and Paul Noth, they stay. Here's a few of their cartoons. This is an interesting cartoon from Drew Dernovich. It's called Accounting Night at the Improv. Now is the part of the show when we ask the audience to shout out some random numbers. And a wonderful style. It's sort of a woodcut style. Everything starts off as black, and he cuts the rest away. Paul Noth, it's Moses saying, he's all right. I just wish he was a little bit more pro-Israel. But I can take rejection because when I got out of graduate school, after Atlanta University, after Fairleigh Dickinson, after Queens College, when I was on the cusp of my PhD, okay, but it was a very big cusp. It was the world's longest cusp. I couldn't even see the end of the cusp. And so I was selling cartoons to the magazine, but between really 1974 and 1977, when I finally sold a cartoon to the New Yorker, I submitted thousands of cartoons, about 2,000, rejection, 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 rejection. Just to backtrack a little, when I quit graduate school, my father, mother, 1907, 1908, so they had been through really difficult times. They basically thought, okay, I wasn't going to be a psychologist, well, maybe then I could work for the welfare department, because at least that was a secure job. You know, and when I told my father, I said, I want to be a cartoonist for the New Yorker. Now, my parents were great. They were very sympathetic, but my father looked at me somberly, seriously, and said, you know, they already have people who do that. I said, yeah, but one of them might die. But the interesting thing is, although my parents definitely did not want me to do this thing, they supported me. Literally supported me, but also supported me. You know, it's like they said, okay, we love you, you know, we give it a try. And my father, and one of the things I say to parents in general is that if you've got a type of kid who wants to do something like this, you know, don't make him go to law school. Don't make him become a doctor. You know, when I look at my particular tribe, and I go to family gatherings, I know what their standard test scores were. by their occupations. That's terrible. They're just doing things because they passed this test of the doctor or the lawyer, and that's what they ended up doing. But they, for the most part, it's not. That's just what they shoved into. So the thing, you know, a joke I do, which when my daughter, when she was in high school, it was, you know, a career day, you know, you go to school and you tell people what you do and everything. And so I'd ask people, I'd say, hey, you know, does anybody want to be a cartoonist? And if anybody raised their hand, I said, great, you can quit school right now. as they escorted me out. But I'm just saying the creative life is a life. And it's part of what this book is, that everything, when you're so young, just to be funneled into something because you're bright or your test score is this, if you have a talent for this, you know, my feeling is you want to give it a shot when you're young. You don't want the situation as I have where people come to me in the office after they're retired and now they want to do cartoons. That's not going to be it. You want to be able to use your youth. And what the other thing I say when I teach at the University of Michigan is the office will always be there, but this won't. So if you got a kid like that, encourage him. Now, when 3 years after I sold my first cartoon, I got this contract from the New Yorker. Contract meant that it was interesting. They paid you more money. You had a bonus. They in no way guaranteed the New Yorker that you would sell any cartoons. There's no guarantee. And that's still how it is. The ultimate judgment was we still got to like the cartoon. But we're supporting you in this way. Now, an interesting thing about this contract, I blurt out the part where I make all the money and the liquor, the women, the cars. I just didn't think that was appropriate. Nowhere in the contract does it mention the word cartoon. It says, for any idea drawing we accept from you with respect to idea drawings. And that's because it's the New Yorker. It's the New Yorker of William Steig and Saul Steinberg. The concept of a drawing that could be humorous or interesting or just amazingly simple and still say something. I mean, when I was looking through all these cartoons at the New York Library, I have a whole chapter on deconstructing the New Yorker cartoons, and I come across Saul Steinberg, and they weren't gag cartoons, and it wasn't the family service, but they were so interesting to me. I mean, he could do something so simple. He could take his thumb, put it on an ink pad, okay, and then there's a thumbprint, and then he drew a little face, then he drew a little body, and then he just put numbers like a prisoner. You know what I mean? So simple, so elegant. All of his stuff was like thinking meditations in ink. So the New Yorker expanded it more, and everybody calls it a cartoon. But to me, the ideas are still the most important thing. I talk about in the book the difference between what I call heads and hands. Now, there are some wonderful cartoonists who are basically hands, which means their drawing is just so fantastic. You know what? Any joke is a bonus. If you looked at Charles Saxon or some wonderful covers, you know, or if you look at a Bruce McCall thing, if it was just a plain cartoon, you know what I mean, it wouldn't be that much. But it's a whole package deal. But the main thing there is the drawing. The idea is the bonus. For me, the idea has to be the main thing. If I have some charm in the drawing, if it's something interesting, that's the bonus. But the idea is the main thing. And when people ask me how I get my ideas, this is flip, a joke, how I get my ideas, I think of them. But that's flip, and I go into much more in the book about the thinking. But thinking, it is thinking. It's thinking humorously, but still it's thinking. It's bringing together references and ideas. You don't have to be able to solve everything on Jeopardy, but you have to sort of know what things are about. Here's another cartoon of mine. There is no justice in the world. There is some justice in the world. The world is just. So for the most part, my cartoons. Now, the thing about the New Yorker cartoons is it's not one thing. It's eclectic. It can be absolutely silly and strange. It can be a cartoon which is just meant to be funny. and there's nothing else going on in it. A great Leo Cullum cartoon where there's a dog in a bar, of course he has a suit, and the bartender is saying to him, "Scotch and toilet water?" It's a great cartoon, but it's only about the joke. And you always have to have a lot of those. But for me personally, I want it to be about something more than the joke. I want it to be a cartoon that somehow also touches on some reality. And I want the reality to have some ambiguity to it, that there's some truth to it. For me, it's all about religion. I do a lot of cartoons about religion, you know, in a sort of benign way, you know, like a guy coming out of church saying to the pastor, "I know he works in mysterious ways, but if I worked that mysteriously, I'd get fired." You know, a lawyer saying to a client, "Act of God? No problem, we sue God." So it's sort of benign, and I said, you know, I often say about this cartoon, you know, I'm just always amazed at all the arguments and about between the three major religions when they're all arguing about who has the best imaginary friend. So that's a card. Just do a little nerdy, wonky stuff about how cartoons deal with our conflicting feelings. Now, this cartoon resonated with a lot of people because it says what they'd like to say but can't say. So it's that feeling, and that we both actually want to be nice, and we have feelings that aren't nice. The way the cartoon is constructed and sort of why it works in this mashup way is because the message is rude, but the language is polite. The syntax is polite. And that's why you need "is never good for you." That's why you can't end it "never," even though that's still a joke. It's just not as good a joke. So my job is basically a job of judgment. So there, because I see the cartoonist on Tuesdays, and now I'll show you a little me of seeing. This is from the 60 Minutes.
Hey, how are you?
Paul.
Robert. Well, I suppose you came in here to show me cartoons.
Every Wednesday, a nervous band of ink-stained wretches gathers at Bob Mankoff's office.
So let's see what you got here.
All right.
Hoping against hope to sell him a cartoon. As for what they're paid, no one's talking.
How many have been accepted, I really don't know.
There's the grizzled veteran Sam Gross, who figures he's submitted 30,000 cartoons, give or take.
30,000?
Yeah.
Many consider this his masterpiece. A dog at Heaven's Gate asking, "Is there any chance of getting my testicles back?"
I still have to push the envelope.
Sam has always pushed the envelope, things that you couldn't quite do. How you doing?
Very well.
There's always a little preliminary chit-chat.
How you been?
All right.
Farley.
Farley Katz specializes in the far out, in both cartoons and facial hair.
So what's going on with that mustache? Are you still entering the contest?
No, I retired from the circuit. This is all like a recreational mustache.
Okay.
And then Mankoff speed reads the rough sketches.
This is just too awkward a drawing.
Most get rejected. He's seen the idea in one form or another before.
You know, like, you know, whenever they open your bag at an airport.
Carolina Johnson has an airport security cartoon with the TSA guy saying, "You can pack this back up now." Yeah. Emily Flake has a joke featuring both King Kong and Godzilla.
The two heavy hitters in the monster world.
It's as simple as that.
Maybe it's just the day for facial hair, but Joe Dana seems to be a contender with a Tarzan cartoon.
The apes are saying, "We found you and raised you as one of us. So we were just wondering, at what point did you learn to shave?"
Can I say, I have researched this. There is no iteration of Tarzan in literature, comic books, or movies in which he has facial hair. It makes no sense.
Right.
Here's some of the stuff around.
This is just stage one, thinning out the candidates to take to the magazine's editor.
This is a little bit too straightforward.
He's largely non-committal, pleasant but blunt.
It won't look right in our magazine.
When a drawing simply isn't good enough.
We're not that impressed. Okay, next. It doesn't have enough charm. So that's what happens on Tuesday as people come in. But what I really do is, you know, I said, unfortunately, I don't have that little laugh meter to do that. And when people ask, well, you know, you have the best job in the world, you must just be laughing all the time. Well, laughing is basically a social phenomenon. And once you go from just, as you are, I hope, enjoying this laughter or enjoying the cartoons to evaluating hundreds of them, you don't laugh anymore, because evaluation is a judgment thing. It mediates it. It stops it. You still know what's funny. And see, my job, I know, this is so heartbreaking, it's not to enjoy the humor myself, but to judge it so that you can enjoy it. Look at the incredible sacrifice I'm making. Sure, your heart goes out to me. But that's true. If you have favorite movies, you have movies you laughed at, great comedies. If I said to you, you know what, I want you to pick your 10 favorite comedies, and I want you to watch all of them, and to evaluate them, and to rate them. Now all of a sudden, you'll be able to tell. You'll say, I know I like this one better than that, but you won't be laughing the same way. You'll be in a critical mode. This is William Hogarth's drawing from the 17th century. It's called The Laughing Audience. Now, everybody is laughing right there, the critic. What I have to do is make sure, or to somehow modify that, I don't become that guy. Now, Matt Diffie, the cartoonist we showed, made a little movie saying, sort of satirizing what he pictures my day is actually like.
Ooh, no. No. Ooh. Too funny. Normally I would, but I'm in a pissy mood. I'm drawing on my own. Perhaps. No. Nah. No. Overdrawn. Underdrawn. Drawn just right. Still not funny enough. No. No. For God's sakes, no. 1,000 times. No. 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 Definitely no. No. No.
Got lunch?
Hey, that's good. Yeah, what you got there?
Got a ham and Swiss on rye?
No.
Okay, pastrami on sourdough?
No, but no.
Smoked turkey with bacon?
No.
Falafel?
Let me look at it. No.
Grilled cheese?
No.
BLT?
No.
Black forest ham and Munster with apple mustard?
No.
Green bean salad?
So that's an exaggeration, but there's a lot of rejection. Now, Matt Diffie, you made that, actually put out a book called The Rejection Collection, which is all the cartoons that we reject. But when you look at it, it's interesting. I'm going to talk a little bit about context. The rejection tells you it's cartoons you never saw and never will see in The New Yorker. So the cartoons, it's a transgressive context. So when we look at that cartoon on the cover, it's a wino drinking, but he's also a ventriloquist and the dummy's throwing up. Okay, so it's a funny cartoon within the context of here. Well, let's look at another one from the rejection collection, a place where it says it's rejection, you expect transgression. Okay. Asshead, please help. Now, all of this is... So you have an insular comedy environment. Within you, this is what you're expecting there. It's like going to a comedy club where some of the humor is blue and stuff. That's what you want, right? But within the context of The New Yorker, I skipped a slide. So one of the ideas behind humor, it's a partial idea, it's an enhancer, is the idea of humor is a benign violation, which means somehow you've got to feel that it's the right amount of wrong. But the right amount of wrong depends on the context. So for the rejection collection, this is the right amount of wrong. You expect wrong, okay? It's right in the middle there. For The New Yorker, this would be terrible. He sell Army about AIDS and immune disorders, and they turn the page and they say, asshead, please help. Can you imagine? I would get calls like, hello? Mr. Mankoff, I have been reading The New Yorker for over 450 years. This is so... You know, so It would just be very, very bad. And why? Because it's totally wrong for the New Yorker. It's totally on that side. So all humor has a context. All humor has a frame. It's a type of play. But the New Yorker is essentially a serious environment. A serious environment is an empathetic environment. Humor, like in the Rejection Club, is the opposite of empathy. It's antipathy, which is a whole class of humor. It's what most humor is, just wrong for the New Yorker. One way to look at humor is it's a type of entertainment. Entertainment is interesting because it often involves some feeling of danger or something might go wrong. That's what a zoo is. I mean, okay, you're over here. I can talk loud enough. I'm from New York. I don't need a microphone. So the danger is here. It's a tiger. The tiger could kill you, but he can't kill you because the bars are here. So you have the feeling of both being in danger and safe. That's like being on a roller coaster. And if you've ever seen, I have a video of someone on a roller coaster. They go up, and when they go down, they laugh. They're both in danger, and they're safe. So this conflict of emotions, is often at the heart of entertainment. Like when you go see a horror film. It's scary, but nothing's going to happen to you, but in some sense it is. So that's sort of what a zoo is, entertainment. That's, an okay zoo. That's a bad zoo. But there are worse zoos. So within the context of the New Yorker, I've got to feel, well, where is the tiger? You know, how much can you, what can you do? You know, like a cartoon like this. Now, this cartoon would seem very benign, right? Really, what's the objection? People get older, they get shorter, all people, who would find that objectionable? I think he would. Email comment on this cartoon, another joke on old white males, ha-ha, the wit. It's nice, I'm sure, to be young and rude, but someday you'll be old unless you drop dead as I wish. So, for some people, it doesn't take very much for that tiger to get out of the cage. Now, you can, you know, the New Yorker, you know, we can sort of push the envelope, you know, a little bit. Okay, this is discouraging data on the antidepressant. Now, it seemed like that got a pretty good response. People thought that was funny. When I do online surveys, see, because part of it's the contagion of laughter, that just as long as enough people, a critical mass finds funny here, everybody else is going to be very, very influenced by this. I mean, I'm a funny guy, but honestly, you know, environments like this, if you're funny, are absolutely ideal because, first of all, you can't say anything but laugh. Right there. I get to talk, you either laugh or don't. So that's your response. Also, there's just tension. Just bunches of people packed together who don't know each other. That's tension. Just the situation itself. Look, here I am, alone. Do an online survey, and everybody is in by themselves, and now they're in the evaluative mode rather than the mode of contagion, and now they're rating the cartoons. You see a more interesting phenomenon. Okay, so I put this cartoon online, and people rated it. Now, most people did like it. The mode, they rated it 10 out of 10, you know, 109. So by far, most people liked it. But let's look at some of the responses. Vote points 3. Only 3 this person rated. I like animals. Look how much they like them. They like them 5. You can't like animals more than 5 exclamation points. I really think it's unhealthy if you like them that much. But let that be. I don't want to hurt them. That doesn't seem very funny to me, okay? This person only rated 2. I don't like to see animals suffer, even in cartoons. And I wrote back to this person. I said, they don't suffer. One, it's just a cartoon. 2, we use anesthetic ink. So there is no suffering. But other people say, guy, seems just like the results of my lab at 10, funny 10, unappealing. This is actually generally when people evaluate individuals. And then in a way, that's a wonderful thing about cartoons. This environment, you've come here, you like me, and I'm telling the jokes, and that's great and everything. But when you get to sit in your living room, you are, you know, I'm here. You paid money to see me, great. But then you paid money to look at the New Yorker magazine. You subscribe. You're the judge. In your own living room, you are the boss. And there you feel judgment. And that's what I really like about cartoons, that they work as content, pretty much separated from personality. So that Jon Stewart is incredibly talented, but really, it's his personality which is selling this stuff. When a cartoon appears, it's the cartoon. It's just a drawing on paper. And so I once had someone call me and say, I got this great cartoonist, like an agent, he's gone, fantastic cartoonist. I said, yes. No, he's fantastic. Could he send me cartoons? He said, well, I don't want to do that yet because he doesn't know how to schmooze. You know, schmooze, like talk, chat. Chat me up or whatever. I said, you know, once they're in the magazine, they can't schmooze. They can't say, hey, how you doing? Look at this cartoon. Now, that's an interesting cartoon for the New Yorker, because that's right at the very edge. And depending on the audience that you show it, when I teach out in at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, it's very, very liberal, you get a laugh like this, ha-ha, ooh. Because the laugh is genuine. The ooh says, I'm a good person, I drive a Prius, you know, believe in global warming. Believe me, that laugh had nothing to do with me. But once again, this shows conflict. Conflicted feelings. We actually are liberal. We do think there should be access to the handicapped. But we probably have conflicted feelings. You know, if it's late at night and you can't use that spot, whatever. Now, this cartoon is very skillful also. First of all, the more realistically this cartoon would be drawn, the worse it would be. The more macabre it would be. Okay? So in terms of this idea of finding the sweet spot of just the right amount of wrong, a lot of skill goes into that. If Jack Siegel, who drew this cartoon, put a guy in a wheelchair going up that ramp, same idea, right? Who do you think went up the ramp? See, so the cartoonists have to find that balance. Look at this cartoon. I figure if I don't have that third martini, then the terrorists win. This was right after 9/11. So once again, it showed really how humor could deal with very difficult situations, not by pointing outward, but pointing backwards really at ourselves. And that's one of the things the New Yorker cartoons do. For the most part, they satirize the very class that read it. So this is also not too far after 9/11, this other cartoon. I wouldn't mind living in a fundamentalist Islamic state. So there, the whole idea of what's going on in terrorism is at a remove. It's there. It's there like the tiger at danger. It's giving us the energy. Very different than a cartoon. I don't have it here. Remember where it's a suicide bomber. Okay, this was in the rejection collection. Suicide bomber. Got the thing all strapped around him. And there's a guy who's like a tailor. And he's down adjusting the belt and he's saying, too snug. We wouldn't want it to chafe. So that would be too strong, actually, for the New Yorker. So humor needs a target. And one of the things about humor is always about things that are bad. Maybe they're not terrible, maybe they're not tragic. Sometimes it is about that. It can't be about anything that's good. There are no cartoons about good marriages. There are no cartoons about great vacations. It's a way of dealing and coping with life. That's why it's important. So while this is an exaggeration, we've all felt like that at one time or another. And that's why I'm for gun control. Look at this cartoon by Roz Chassis. It's got his obituaries. 2 years younger than you, 12 years older than you, 3 years between you, exactly your age. So this cartoon is so funny because it's so true. And it's a very deep, deep cartoon. And I think this is the cartoons of the New Yorker are satirizing the very class that are reading it. And I think that makes them more nuanced. Excuse me, I think there's something wrong with this in a tiny way that no one other than me would ever be able to pinpoint. Which reminds me of my mother, Molly, because when I was, my mother grew up on the Lower East Side, right out of Hester Street. But my father did very good, I talk about this in the book, after the war when he came back from the army, in wall-to-wall carpeting. That was a big thing in the 50s. It shows you had made it. My wife won't let me put any wall-to-wall carpeting in the house because now it's somehow déclassé. But then it was great, and I have a little chapter about that. And then my mother became, you know, sort of this Jewish queen once we had money. So she would be talking normally, and even sometimes she'd talk in Yiddish. But if the phone rang, she'd answer and say, "Hello." But this is like before this. This is on a total tangent. But my mother, whenever we went to the restaurant, would give these incredibly detailed instructions about the food, even if it was a bagel. I mean, you needed, and you know, this poor Hispanic guy is trying to decipher, like you would need an engineer's degree to create this bagel. And finally it would come, and my mother like had an anti-missile system that she would stop it before it got to the table. No. You know, no. Just the story. This is a great cartoon. I started my vegetarianism for health reasons, then it became a moral choice, and now it's just to annoy people. Sometimes deal with social issues. This is one of mine. By the way, what's your position on some sex marriage? And this is a great cartoon on the same topic. Gays and lesbians getting married, haven't they suffered enough? So there's an ambiguity to the New Yorker cartoon, and I think there's a deep humanity. But not everybody gets New Yorker cartoons. And there was a famous episode on Seinfeld where Elaine doesn't understand the cartoon. And I have a whole chapter on that in the book. And that people say to me, "How did you feel about that episode?" Well, it was written by a very well-known cartoonist of ours, Bruce Eric Kaplan, goes by the initials B-E-K. And so originally, when Bruce first told me he was writing this episode, my joke was, "Et tu, Bruce?" So let's look at this sort of opening scene.
This cartoon in The New Yorker. I don't get this.
Me neither.
And you're on the fringe of the humor business. Hey, George, look at this.
That's cute.
You get it?
No, never mind.
Come on. We're two intelligent people here. We can figure this out. Now we got a dog and a cat in an office.
It looks like my accountant's office, but there's no pets working there.
The cat is saying, "I've enjoyed reading your email."
It's got something to do with that 42 in the corner.
That's a page number.
Well, I can't crack this one.
So one of the things I do in the book, I won't go through this, is I deconstruct the whole episode. And I show sort of the reality between what actually goes on and the kernel of truth in the episode, which is that not everybody gets the New Yorker cartoon. In fact, we run something in the cartoon issue called the cartoon IQ test. I don't get it with cartoons like this. Pi what squared? Long John, you should be able to get this. Arr! Arr, mateys, don't you know pirate talk? One of the ways to look at humor is, I look at it, I have this diagram, it's not monolithic, it's not one thing. There's humor that is absolutely within the realm of reality and a quip like this cartoon from William Hamilton. Oh yes, we know them, we hate them. And that's very, very funny, but it could happen, okay? Then there's humor like this. The ringing in your ears, I think I can help. So in both of these cartoons, there's something to get. You know, there's frames of reference to put together. In this cartoon by Jack Siegler, there's nothing at all to get. You either like the loopiness of it, almost like you'd like a Thurber drawing, or you don't. Damn it, Hopkins, didn't you get yesterday's memo? Now, most people go absolutely for a gag all the time. Generally, younger people will go for more absurd, where there isn't all this closure. Also, to some extent, the more liberal you are, the more you like modern art, atonal music, all sorts of things like that, which you don't necessarily have to put together, the more you like sort of weird humor. Like, let's say that there's a cartoon we recently published called Paninis of the Old West. And it has a panini on the railroad tracks. What, people are sympathetic for the panini? You are sensitive, you know, with the villain holding it down. So it's like pairing apples to oranges, and these are what? All right, kiwis, very good. So I don't do that. The New Yorker, when we construct the magazine, to me it's very, very eclectic. I actually want the wide range. And sometimes the weirder cartoons enable you to get slightly less weird cartoons where everyone's saying, I love that. How to win the New Yorker Caption Contest. Well, we don't have time for that. But we know it's very hard. This is from Bored to Death with Ted Danson.
What would a police duck say to a suicidal bear? You can bear it. Now, God, that's terrible. I'm never going to win this thing.
What are you doing?
But it is hard. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal about all the celebrities who have tried to win it. And Roger Ebert did actually win it after 107 tries. So I'm gonna summarize here. I had my assistant, Mark Philippe Eskenazi, who is a very talented musician, put How to Win the Caption Contest into a song, and I actually tell you more about that in the chapter, but let's listen to him.
Find the cartoon on our website. Come up with some words for a caption you like. Try to make it feel like a hand in a glove. That's the kind of writing that we're liking to love. Watch it as they keep on writing. Come just and keep on striving. Win the caption contest.
Now, sometimes, Mark, I'm here with some way, I hope you heard that. Sometimes the very best caption, of course, is the simplest. So part of my talk is to have made you just do that. I do want to do a little plug for my website, which now you can go and look at all my cartoons, and you could order my book and do whatever else. My publisher wanted me to do that. And now, let us open the floor to questions. Thank you very much. Do we have any time? Did I go too long?
It's okay. I think we'll just take two.
Okay. Just a few questions. But we have to take more than two. Can't have two. Any questions? Okay. I went a little long, I'm sorry. All the questions are answered in the book.
You mentioned before you got published at The New Yorker that you did get some cartoons in other magazines. What other magazines?
A Saturday Review of Literature, the National Lampoon. I had stuff in the Times and, you know, medical journals, all sorts of things. Any more?
Yeah, over here.
Okay.
What made you decide to publish Roz Chess' recent
Roz Chess was published in 1978, well before I became, she was a genius? Oh, well, that's part of a book that's called, can we talk about that? It's a fantastic thing about her elderly parents and dying in 95, and, you know, it's, I guess because it's great. I don't have any answer. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit, and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.